Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. So now that I've introduced the four right efforts of avoiding, overcoming, developing, and maintaining, and I've even given some interesting examples of each one, I'd like to talk more about them in a general way. Buddhism provides a lot of structure for us to practice within. This monastery you're in, that's definitely a very structured, you might say, institution, you know, to have a monastery at all, to have a sangha, the way that we monks have seniority, you know, this is all structure, and it's a good system. In that it's worked all this time, ever since the Buddha. It's rather amazing that it still is alive today. It must be a pretty good system if it lasted this long. There's structure like the five precepts, eight precepts, and there's the 10 precepts there are like 10 precept nuns here in Malaysia. Maybe you've heard of the Sayales. Those are 10 precept nuns. Then there's the 227 rules for bhikkhus like myself. Then there are these commentaries to the Vinaya. There's even more than the 227. There's like hundreds more in these commentaries. Anyway, structure. But when you read the early Buddhist texts, there's also some flexibility, which the Buddha leaves on the table for the monks and nuns. There's a surprising amount of flexibility. So one of these forms of flexibility, I could list many, but one of the interesting ones is... there was such strong support for holy men and women in ancient India, in Jambudvipa. There was, they called it Samana culture. Samana. So Samana seems to come from the same word as shaman. It was kind of like shaman culture. There were all these wanderers and sages and sadhus. If you go to India today, they still got these sadhus everywhere. Hindu sadhus, all kinds of different sadhus. India still has this. And so Buddhism was able to sort of draw upon this support. And like the Buddha never invented going for alms round, that already existed. The Buddhist monks and nuns just kind of participated in this cultural, I guess you might say, opportunity which India provided, which was very progressive, really. You don't see that very often in most countries. When Buddhism spread to China, by the way, there were laws about you weren't allowed to beg in public. So when Buddhism came, the monks and nuns had to take up growing their own vegetables and you know, feeding themselves, which the Buddha doesn't allow the digging of plants, destroying of plants. Buddhist monks and nuns can plant those plants and not break Vinaya, but we cannot dig the soil and damage plants. Anyway, but there was an adaption in China to adjust. Just an interesting note. But anyway, the Buddha does permit adjusting to local customs when Buddhism spreads to other countries. Whenever a monk would go to some far-off land and then come back and say, this far-off land is different than Jambudvipa, they have these different customs. Is it okay if I just follow those customs? The Buddha always says yes, every time. He never gives that monk a hard time. He always says, well, you know, it's well and good that this practice, this tradition is being spread to other places. That's good. So he's just happy it spreads at all, it seems, when asked about these things. So the Buddha is a very sensible, reasonable person. And he will, by default, grant flexibility. As long as the monks and nuns have enough, you might say, spiritual maturity, he virtually always lets them practice alone, make a lot of decisions as to their own practice, how they're going to do it. You know, it's just that they're mindful somehow with one of his meditation methods. He doesn't micromanage them, which is really nice. But if some monks are behaving really badly, okay, he will put his foot down, sometimes pretty harshly. But it's surprisingly rare. So he's not a total pushover. We got this term, pushover, meaning like someone who never puts their foot down, someone who's too tolerant, too easygoing, too slack. One of the interesting types of flexibility permitted is once a monk or a nun earns their independence, it's called independence. Like the monks have to have this 5-year period of dependence or nisaya, where they have to train under some teacher, their acharya. And it's almost like a master and apprentice, or a teacher and apprentice sort of a thing. It's a bit like a medieval style apprenticeship where the student learns from the teacher in this rather like friendly, close way. The Buddha actually says in the Vinaya, it should be like a father and son kind of a relationship, father to son. Like if there's some, you know, kindness in it, like a good father would have. The father makes time for his son, that kind of thing. Anyway, once the monks sort of have the maturity to be released from their nisaya, their dependence, which is at about the 5-year mark, perhaps a little more, then they're free to go traveling to other monasteries and other places to practice. And India was very, how can I put this, supportive of this. If you had your alms bowl and your robes, you could pretty much just walk from one village to the next. And you could go to any village and knock on any door, pretty much, and get offered alms food. You had to do it between dawn and noon. So there were, you know, there's a little bit of rules around this. You couldn't go for a midnight snack or something like that. There was a monk who tried that, and that didn't go over well. It scared this woman badly, and then the Buddha had to lay down this rule about dawn until noon. That's when we have to collect our alms food and eat it. Even to this day, there are monks in Sri Lanka who do this practice, which is spoken of in the suttas, called charika. Charika. C-A-R-I-K-A. And basically they wander from, town to town, and you know, usually it's like one town per day. They'll just sleep overnight in each of the towns. They just find where the local Buddhist monastery is, eat their lunch there, and then sleep overnight, and then leave early in the morning, like early in the morning when it's the coolest time of the day. And then walk several hours, and you know, usually in 3, 4, 5 hours, now you arrive at that next village. And the idea is to get there before lunch. You know, you kind of arrive into the town at, I don't know, 9 or 10 a.m., and there's still time to find the monastery, show up, and then, oh, look, a Buddhist monk, you know, okay, oh, have you eaten? Well, no, I haven't. Oh, well, let's put out a spot for you, and you can eat lunch with us. So that's the idea, is just go monastery to monastery, and then, you know, or maybe you can collect some alms food in the town as well. So this charaka thing still happens today. I personally know monks who've done this. And so the Buddha permits this choice in kind of where you might decide to go and practice. As long as you follow Vinaya. And your practice has to be skilled enough, you know, you have to be getting some happiness and peace and, you know, rewardingness out of your practice. And that's going to be the, shall we say, motivating, you know, sustaining it's the sustaining thing you're going to need to stay a monk and not disrobe. If you're not having any fun at all being a monk, you know, through practice, you're probably going to disrobe. There are suttas about that. It's true. It needs to be enjoyable to some degree to be worth doing. So the Buddha permitted the monks, you know, like I say, this flexibility as to where they would practice, how they would practice. Granted, they had the independence. And what I like about that is it, shall we say, accommodates how the different monks had different personalities, okay? I don't know if you ever lived in a monastery before, but you're going to find every, you know, there's a big range of personalities in all these different monks and nuns, especially Westerners. If you find it fascinating to watch interesting and perhaps even a little bit eclectic people, you know, people within, you know, rather unusual personalities. Western monasteries have a lot of these types, okay? if you're a people watcher, you're going to love it. Anyway, I feel that this system has to have some sort of flexibility in it to accommodate this wide range of personalities. Like back at the time of the Buddha, there was... psychology had not been invented yet. Okay, psychology's got a whole bunch of technical terms that are fantastic for describing, you know, people's personalities and their behavior and different patterns. And, you know, I personally find that kind of thing interesting, but in a hobbyist, amateur kind of way. I'm not a psychologist, but wow, there's some pretty insightful terms they've come up with. So these didn't really exist yet at the time of the Buddha. Like, the Buddha knew what morality was, absolutely. And he has a lot to say about morality. And he basically said about as much as you could hope anyone could have said back in those times. You know what I mean? He did as good a job as you could have asked for where they were at the time. And I feel he's extremely wise to come up with a system which accommodated this all the differences in personality. So he noted, there's an interesting sutta where he noted that like he has several sort of chief disciples, like, you know, kind of outstanding disciples. Sariputta and Moggallana were kind of the two chief disciples. Those were his two favorites. But there were a number of other well-known, excellent disciples as well. Monks like, let's say, Ananda or Aniruddha. Kassapa, yes, Mahakassapa. There were several of these. And each of them had their own, you might say, talents and their own personalities. Actually, not much is said about their personalities, but they are definitely praised for their talents. You know, what were they good at? What was their strength? All these chief disciples would have some outstanding strength. And the Buddha noted that more junior monks who had a similar strength or a similar, you know, personality would sort of flock together to be with those best monks. So Ananda would have a bunch of monks flocking to him, and they all loved to memorize and study, and they were more kind of like scholarly and intellectual. Those kind of monks flocked to Ananda. Okay, and then Venerable Sariputta, he was the foremost in concentration, like samadhi. So monks who were very excellent, you know, meditators, and they were very like logical and very, they were great at investigation of Dhamma. Sariputta called himself a little kind of, you know, nickname he'd call himself is a thousand ways investigator. So when he wanted to learn something new from, you know, the Buddha or maybe some other monk, he'd be like, well, can you explain this thing in brief? And then, you know, the person would say like, well, maybe I'm, you know, some other monk would say, well, I'm not the greatest teacher, but, you know, I can try to explain it. And then Venerable Sariputta would say like, it's okay. I'm a thousand ways investigator. I will investigate that from every direction and I will understand it. Totally, you know, you just tell me what you know. That's good enough. So that those kind of monks would flock to Venerable Sariputta. I would say Venerable Sariputta is my favorite, by the way. I'm more of that sort of a person, more logical, you know, rational thinking sort of person. Anyway, so they, if you had psychic powers, then you would flock to Maha Moggallana. Moggallana was the was known for his psychic powers, and so on and so forth. So, you know, they didn't have psychology, but there was a, you might say, acknowledgement and even accommodation for their differences. Okay, and the ability to travel around was nice too. So if you let's say heard of some monk who was kind of living the lifestyle you wanted to also live, you could go travel and live with them. Go wandering, you know, even if they were hundreds of kilometers away, no problem. You know, you just go village to village in this charika kind of way, and yeah, you'd eventually get there. And it was a very likable system. So, so that supportiveness from the people of India is tremendously worthy of respect and you know, gratitude, because that kind of made this whole system work. There's some, I'm so tempted to share this. kind of recent study I heard about on the internet, which says something about human nature. And before I mention it, it is as though the Buddha sort of knew this and cleverly avoided a problem I'm about to tell you about. It is as though he could see the problem coming and avoided it, okay? So I'm already praising the Buddha before I tell you the problem, okay? So Westerner scientists, there's this one famous kind of Westerner psychologist, kind of scientist guy. He studied wolves and how wolves live together in packs. And so he was studying these wolves living in captivity. It was like a pack of wolves living in a kind of like a zoo for the wolves. And he noted that they had a very strong hierarchy, and the lead wolf was extremely dominant and very like controlling and very aggressive. And you know, if anybody messed with him, he would immediately kind of lash out at them, you know, keep everyone, all the other wolves in line. And he was very like protective of his power, you know. So this scientist invented the concept of an alpha wolf, okay? So this scientist made that term up himself. And it's not that old. It was only invented, I don't know, 20 years, 30 years ago, something like that. Anyway, so this term alpha wolf really caught on. And you hear people talking about this in the West. I don't know about Malaysia here, but you know, there's sort of this thought that like, well, yeah, humans are like this too, you know. You see humans being really aggressive and domineering and, you know. So there's this thought that, okay, there are like alpha males too, like alpha human males, just like those wolves. And so there's all this, it's like a pop culture sort of a term. And everyone was sort of, shall we say, assuming, well, this is just a natural part of nature. Of course, you're going to have alpha males. You're going to have very strong personalities. You're going to have very, you know, powerful, strong leaders, you know, like authoritarian, tough, you know, bossy leaders, right? But then this same scientist had a big, you might say, breakthrough. This is the same scientist who invented the term alpha wolf. So, you know, 20, 30 years later, he's still a scientist and he's still studying wolves. You know, he's still researching. So their research methods had improved quite a lot. And now they were able to observe the wolves living in the wild, not the zoo, okay? They could observe the wolves in this very quiet and sort of like unobtrusive way. They had techniques to kind of hide from the wolves really carefully and still observe them in the wild. So this revealed the wolves' more natural behavior in the wild, okay? When there's and the wolves don't know the humans are there. They're just doing their normal thing. And it turns out when wolves are living in the wild, they're way different than when they are in the zoo, and they're all sort of trapped in the zoo, kind of like prisoners, okay? So these first wolves were, you might say, like prisoners in the zoo, but these second wolves were not prisoners. They were in the wild, and they had the freedom to go wherever they wanted and do whatever they wanted, and they're so much more mellow in the wild when they have that freedom. They have that freedom to go where they want and do what they want. And now the wolves still have a leader in the wild, but that leader, he doesn't need to be this aggressive and mean and, you know, harsh and, you know what I mean? He He's not this really domineering leader. He does demand respect from the other wolves once in a while, okay? A tiny bit. The only time that the scientists could really see this was when if the wolves killed something to eat, okay, let's say they kill a deer. So now they're going to eat it. Now the leader wolf and his sort of wife, you might say, the woman wolf of the male leader, they have the privilege of eating first. So that's what their high status lets them do, is they get first pick of this deer. And then so on and so forth, they kind of take turns in order of their seniority, you might say, like their position in the hierarchy. And if any other wolf kind of tries to cheat and eat earlier, then that leader will be like, you know, like, burr. He'll just give him a tiny little bark, you know, a tiny little growl, like, burr. You know, like, don't do that. But that's it. That's it. There's no biting. There's no blood. There's no fighting. There's no... It's so small that the scientist almost missed it. It was just the tiniest little growl. That was enough. And then the alpha wolf or whatever went back to the eating. And the other wolf who was about to cheat, you know, kind of backs off. And the scientists were blown away, and they're like, okay, so this is what wolves are really like in the wild. And all this stuff we've been saying about the alpha wolf and stuff, that only applies when they're in the zoo. That only applies when they're living in captivity. Okay? So it is a mistake for you might say, this term alpha wolf to become a big thing. You know, like, oh yeah, every CEO of a company, he's like the alpha wolf. He should be tough. He should be mean. He should be cruel and, you know, harsh. And no. It is, that does not follow from... When you look at how the wolves live and how much freedom those wolves have, means everything as to whether they're mellow or not. Okay. So back to, you know, the Buddha here and how he ran the Sangha. When those monks who have their independence are free to move around, can you see the parallel here? It's like, yeah, we can expect them to be happy, mellow monks also when they have their freedom to move around. And they're not like prisoners in a zoo, you know, like trapped in a cage kind of a thing. So whether monks have the freedom to move around or not turns out to have a big impact, psychologically. Yeah, so I think it was wise for the Buddha to grant this freedom to the monks. Granted, they had the freedom from their independence. There is a training period. Every new monk, you know, frankly, should go through. There's a lot to learn. There's a lot, you know, there's a lot of, shall we say, help that new monks will need to sort of learn the culture, learn the customs, learn the appropriate behavior such that they can kind of fit in when they travel around. Okay? So yeah, I just thought I'd mention that. It is a good system in that it provides flexibility. Okay? But there's still some structure too. So this retreat I'm doing here is, you know, the timetable is structured, etc. But I am providing you some freedom as to which object of meditation you do. You're going to need to do a little experimenting. There's going to be a trial and error, meaning like you try one thing for a while Maybe it doesn't work so well. Okay, we'll try something a little different. Is that any better? You see? And gradually, hopefully, you will find things that work better for you. And you have the flexibility to do sitting meditation or walking meditation. Okay, and the key here is that you stay in the present. And you're trying to find a way of doing this where you feel relaxed, happy, peaceful, even blissful. Better yet. Okay? So if you're wondering, you know, why do we have so much freedom to pick these different methods? Because a lot of other retreats, you're not really given much freedom at all as to your object of meditation. Yeah, usually it's kind of a one-size-fits-all kind of a technique. Now what I will say to you is, well, if you feel that that's too much freedom, too much choice, okay, fine, mindfulness of body. That's the default that I would have you do, if only to find the areas of your body that are numb, desensitized, blank. You know, you can't feel anything. And like, you know, see if you can regain sensitivity. And also this can help to ground you in your body. And I feel this is especially important in a time when, you know, there's frankly too much smartphone use. And people are going to almost like lose their grounding in their own bodies. I feel that is a problem that needs to be pushed back against. So that's why I'm giving that to you as a default. Okay? If you don't know what to do. So it's not like if you just feel very unsure of what to do. Okay, well, there is a default. Okay? All right. Are there any questions? Okay, the question is it true that a monk can only ordain seven times and, you know, disrobe seven times and then you cannot come back for an eighth time? I'm unaware of any rule like that. It's certainly not one of the original 227. There might be some like really, really, really sub-commentarial rule somewhere that I'm not aware of. My sense is no, that's not an official rule anywhere. I've never heard of that. I would say I need to see a citation for that before I believe it. Okay, so the question is, are there monks that just disrobe and come back, disrobe and come back? Well, there are temporary ordinations. I know in Thailand and here in even Malaysia, there are temporary ordinations. It's usually for the younger generation, you know, teenagers. Thailand kind of treats it as almost like a rite of passage where young men are kind of toughened up in their manliness and makes them more of like an eligible man to be married. It's kind of like it's a way of proving your manliness, you know, proving that you deserve to be treated as a man. But do they do this over and over again? I never really hear about that, no. Usually they'll just do that once or perhaps just a few times. It's not really, I don't hear about that being like abused, at least not in the world of Theravada. I have heard that there are some Mahayana traditions where they've drifted away from the Vinaya so far that there are monks who... they sort of just act like a monk during the day, putting on the robes and kind of going through the motions. It's almost like a performance as a priest. But at the end of the day, they take their robes off, they have a wife, you know, it's just sort of almost like a job, and they just put that uniform on for the job, almost like a police officer puts on his uniform, you know, goes to work, comes home, takes off his uniform again. There are actually a couple of Mongolian monks here, and they mentioned that the there's some Vajrayana Buddhism where they come from. This is right where Mongolia and Russia are. That's where they're from. And yeah, there's Vajrayana there as a default, and they're monks like that. Yeah, but I don't claim to represent or know all that much about Mahayana or Vajrayana. Okay, so the question is, when one's eyes are attracted to sights, attracted to colors, these colors you speak of, are these like colors happening in your mind, or just the colors of things out in the world? Just anything out in the world.
The course of eyes supposed to be dark red, sometimes it's bright.
Oh, interesting. So these are colors you see even when you close your eyes.
Yeah.
Okay, well... Okay, well, that is sort of expected that, yeah, it's surprising, it's even kind of amazing, and it is tempting to kind of be drawn to it, and it'll be hard not to be surprised by it, okay? Hopefully, over time, once this happens again and again, each time you will get a little bit more, you might say, steadfast in remaining with your object of meditation. So if you're doing mindfulness of body, you keep doing that mindfulness of body. If you're doing mindfulness of breath, you keep doing the mindfulness of breath. Okay? Just like I was saying yesterday about focus on the inputs. Those are the inputs, what your object of meditation. And for you to see those colors when you close your eyes, that's an output, okay? Leave the output alone. I know it's hard. I know it's like fascinating and, you know, kind of wonderful even, almost magical. But if you want for your meditation to deepen even further, you have to learn to leave those outputs alone. Now, I don't say ignore them. Okay, so there's sort of a middle ground here where you're not like grasping at it or stuck on it or attracted to it, but you're not ignoring it either. You just kind of leave it be. Okay, that's the middle path here. It's almost like a frog came in the room and he kind of went hopping by you. Okay, well, sure, you know he's there, but you don't pick him up. And it's not like you didn't notice him either. Yes, you noticed the frog was there. Okay? But you leave him alone. Yeah, so this is like that. It's something that you... you know it's happening, for sure. But can you return back to your object of meditation? And have that as your highest priority. Okay? And you leave those colors alone. Those are kind of like a secondary effect, okay? It's a secondary thing. Okay? All right.